How do you like my new car? Isn't diesel dirty?
Oh, say it's beautiful, for Christ's sake.
I think it's beautiful, but aren't diesels dirty?
Yeah, that's true.
Oh, that used to be dirty. This is 2015.
No. Listen to me, Terry. Diesel in Latin means dirty. It's not dirty, but you still have a dirty mind.
I do not.
Yes, you do.
That's a Volkswagen ad from this year touting the cleanliness of diesel fuel. The ad has since been pulled from VW's YouTube page, along with all of Volkswagen's diesel car commercials. Today, the company's CEO apologized after news that the German automaker has been deliberately cheating on smog tests. Nearly 500,000 diesel-powered Audis and Volkswagens since 2009 have come pre-installed with illegal software known as a defeat device. That software detects when the car is in for smog testing, and only then do emissions control systems kick in that allow the car to pass the test. Then, out on the open road, the cars produce up to 40 times as much pollution as allowed by the Clean Air Act. The EPA has ordered Volkswagen to recall the affected vehicles at a potential cost of $18 billion. Joining me now to discuss all of this is Tyson Slocum. He directs the energy program at Public Citizen, and that's a nonpartisan consumer advocacy group. Welcome to the program, Tyson.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Well, nice to have you. And tell us, how was this defeat device discovered?
It was discovered because there's this international nonprofit organization that basically works with nations all over the world to assist with air monitoring and air compliance programs. And so they do emissions testings of vehicles all over the world. And they started to notice some curious things with a lot of the diesel Volkswagens, where they would test the car in the lab and then do a road test, and they were getting different results. And so they wanted to do a deeper dive. They worked with a university in West Virginia that had a ton of advanced equipment, and they did a cross-country drive with a couple of diesel VWs, and they got off-the-charts differences between how those cars tested in a laboratory versus how they tested on the open road. And so they forwarded these concerns to the Environmental Protection Agency, which is the U.S. federal agency that regulates air emissions from automobiles, and that was over a year ago. And so the EPA did its own independent tests, found similar results, and they confronted Volkswagen with this, and Volkswagen denied it. Volkswagen at first claimed that it was some sort of testing issue, that it was a technical problem. They claimed that they then fixed it. Succeeding tests by the EPA showed that it wasn't. And when the EPA started to open up the black box of this program in these cars, they found that the program itself was designed to evade testing. So basically what happened was the computer was designed, if it's being tested in a laboratory setting based upon, say, the position of the steering wheel or if the car wasn't moving, then its emissions capture system would work perfectly. If the car was exhibiting signs of being actually driven and not being stuck in a laboratory, then the emissions control systems were told to turn off.
So why would they do that? Why would Volkswagen do this? Would the car get a better performance without these?
Absolutely. Much better performance, better fuel economy. And so Volkswagen had a lot to gain because they could lie to customers and say, listen, your car exceeds the most stringent air quality standards, so you can drive this car knowing that you're protecting the planet while still getting top-level performance.
And also not charging a small amount for that. These are
exactly
not cheap cars.
When in reality, I think what happened here is that Volkswagen's engineers weren't able to marry their emissions control program with increasing performance and power for the automobile while driving. And so faced with this dilemma, executives at Volkswagen appear to say, you know what, let's keep performance and let's lie to regulators about our cleanliness of these automobiles. This is a major fraud investigation, and one of the most blatant efforts to actively mislead regulators and consumers. And there's going to be serious repercussions for Volkswagen as a result.
So let's talk about those fines in the, what, billions of dollars?
Oh, most certainly. I mean, this is a Clean Air Act violation. So at a minimum, you're looking at a Clean Air Act violation fine for every vehicle not in compliance. And so that fine would be around $37,000, $37,500 per vehicle. So multiply that by almost 500,000 vehicles, and you're getting up into $18 billion in fines. That's just for fines for violating the Clean Air Act. You also have to understand that the company is going to be subject to civil litigation in the form of class action lawsuits by people who bought a car thinking that they were getting high performance and strong emission standards when Volkswagen clearly was lying to them. And so people are going to be due financial compensation. That's going to cost the company billions of dollars. And then you've got the situation of criminal negligence. Did the company violate criminal statutes in committing fraud? And so there's a chance, and we are going to be actively pushing for criminal charges against any and all executives who were in the decision-making on this thing.
And then on top of it, they're going to have to pay to fix the cars that don't have that have these devices in them, right?
Absolutely. And so, you know, this comes at a very critical time for Volkswagen. They have prioritized expanding into the U.S. market. Their stock price has already taken a hit. And so it is going to be very important for Volkswagen's financial health. What kinds of decisions are they going to be making in the next couple of weeks? We already know that for the last year, they were stalling and misleading federal investigators who were looking into these discrepancies. So that's not good. The fact that Volkswagen is already on record as having tried to stall and mislead investigators.
All
now
right.
The company came out on Sunday. The CEO apologized and said, you know, we need to win back consumer trust. They announced they're going to initiate an internal investigation. Is that internal investigation going to be a PR job where they try to cover things up? Or are they actually going to reveal what executives made key decisions, fire them, and then hold them up to potential criminal prosecution
okay.
in the United States?
Yeah, we will stay tuned for that one. Tyson Slocum, Director of the Energy Program at Public Citizen, thank you so much.
It was my pleasure.
Well, do you own one of these cars, a Volkswagen or an Audi, a diesel-powered one that's going to be recalled? Let us know how you feel about this. 1-844-PRESS-PLAY, or you can comment on our Facebook page, KCRW Press Play. Coming up, Stephen Brill is here to talk about his massive investigation into Johnson & Johnson, how the company found a way around federal regulators to market an antipsychotic drug to children and seniors. The company apparently knew there would be lawsuits, but decided the profits were worth the payouts. That story is next on Press Play.
Take KCRW with you on one of our smartphone apps. Available for the iPhone, Android, and BlackBerry. You can stream KCRW live, listen to podcasts, and all our news and music streams. Learn more and download at kcrw.com/apps.
You're listening to Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. In 1994, Johnson & Johnson started selling an antipsychotic drug called Risperdal. The FDA approved it for adults with schizophrenia, but it expressly forbade Johnson & Johnson from marketing Risperdal to treat children and the elderly. There were just too many dangerous side effects. Nevertheless, for more than a decade, that's exactly what Johnson & Johnson did. And despite government sanctions for its behavior and thousands of lawsuits, the company made billions in profits. And the guy who headed up the sales effort for Risperdal, he's now Johnson & Johnson's CEO. Journalist Stephen Brill just completed a very long investigative piece on this story. It's called America's Most Admired Lawbreaker, and it's being released in 15 chapters by the Huffington Post. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. By the way, it's also a podcast for those who want to listen to it in their cars.
Okay, so it's a multimedia affair
yeah.
you have. So first, tell us about Risperdal. What is it supposed to do for patients who take it?
Well, it's what's known as a second-generation antipsychotic. basically they calm people down, and they're supposed to be used, according to the FDA, for severe psychotic disorders such as schizophrenia. However, although that's what the FDA restricted its use for on the label, and specifically told Johnson & Johnson, don't try to market this to children because it's too strong and maybe too dangerous. We don't have enough data. Don't market it to children, and don't market it to for use by the elderly because there seems to be a high incidence of strokes and other cardiovascular events that are related to the elderly, as well as diabetes. Johnson & Johnson plunged headlong into aggressive marketing campaigns directed at doctors who prescribe drugs for children and for the elderly.
So for the people who it's approved for, is it effective?
For many of them, yes. I mean, you know, as with a lot of prescription drugs, but in particular this one, for its intended use, it's quite effective, which is why the FDA approved it. It's just that drug companies as a general matter, and Johnson & Johnson in particular, get much more ambitious. You know, the profit margins on these drugs are so high. I mean, it costs Johnson & Johnson, you know, pennies for each pill, and they sell them, you know, for $2, $3, $4, $5. So if they have $1 billion a year in revenue, they have like $950 million a year in profit. So every doctor they get to prescribe this drug is like an annuity of thousands of dollars each time a prescription is written.
So what did its leaders say when it got this FDA prohibition against marketing to children and the elderly? Did they just say, you know, internally, we're just going to ignore this?
Well, I don't have any document that says internally we're going to ignore this. I do have documents and quote documents that say to salespeople, keep doing exactly what you're doing. We'll get approval to do this, you know, sooner or later. And they just kept going.
And what did they do? What were they? How were they marketing?
Well, they
it?
Would do things like they made a multi-$100 million deal with a company called Omnicare that runs the pharmacies at hundreds and thousands of nursing homes around the country to give them paybacks. The government charged this was an illegal kickback based on the number of prescriptions for Risperdal that these pharmacies wrote for people in nursing homes for whom it was basically being used for restlessness and, you know, people who were irritable at nursing homes and didn't sleep through the night. And that was something that the government was quite exercised about and ultimately prosecuted Johnson & Johnson, and that ended up in a plea bargain in which the corporation, not any individual, the corporation pled guilty to a misdemeanor and paid in civil fines and criminal fines $2.2 billion, which sounds like a lot of money until you compare it to the amount of profit they made while they were doing this.
And what was the amount of profit?
Well, if you add up all the off-label selling they did, they probably had $20 billion in profit, of which about half was off-label. And with all the fines and all the costs and the civil suits, the plaintiff suits and everything else, they probably still ended up with anywhere from $4 to $8 billion in profit after they got caught. I mean, this is the worst possible scenario, which is they got caught red-handed, prosecuted, plaintiff's lawyers piled onto them with, you know, lost thousands of lawsuits because the young boys who took the drug developed a deformity that is pretty bad. They got male breasts, and one of the trials I write about was this young boy in Alabama who developed 46 double D breasts as a 12-year-old.
So given the fact that the FDA had prohibited the marketing of this to children and to the elderly, why would doctors, pediatricians, geriatric physicians, why would they go ahead and prescribe this drug?
Well, they were bombarded by messages, by seminars and articles written by other doctors, highly respected colleagues, who said that this drug was a terrific solution, for example, to ADD and ADHD in kids, and for irritability associated with dementia in seniors. What they didn't know or chose not to pay attention to was that those doctors who were writing these articles and giving hundreds and hundreds of seminars, medical seminars, were being paid by Johnson & Johnson to do it.
You tell the story of Dr. Joseph Biederman. I wonder if you could summarize that for us and exactly how he fits into this.
Sure. Here's a highly respected pediatrician associated with Harvard and Mass General Hospital. His adherents really swear by him as a pioneer in developing the science that says that kids with behavior disorders have some kind of chemical imbalance in their brains, which I'm sure to some degree is true, and a lot of people think it's true, and it's been accepted. He gets financed to the tune of $2 million to set up a center at Mass General for the study of these behavior disorders, and it ends up being a series of seminars and advocacy activities related to using Risperdal to treat these behavior disorders in children, all the while it's not indicated on the FDA-approved label. Now, doctors under the law are allowed to prescribe a drug for anything. Once a drug has been approved for any use by the FDA, a doctor, in his or her judgment, looking at an individual patient, can decide, I want to use that drug to treat that patient. And oftentimes, that's not a bad thing. Let's say a drug has been approved to treat a certain kind of cancer, but a doctor looking at his patient who has a different kind of cancer, but for whom there's very little hope, says, I've looked at the medical literature, I've looked at the science, I'm an expert in this stuff, and I want to try this drug on this patient. The doctor can do that, and that's not a bad thing. What is arguably a bad thing is when you have a concerted campaign to pay hundreds of doctors and pay for dozens of medical journal articles advocating the use of a drug in children and the elderly for which the FDA has said it's not supposed to be used. And that's not me saying that's a bad thing. That's the U.S. government saying that's a bad thing. And ultimately, it's Johnson & Johnson agreeing it's a bad thing and negotiating a $2.2 billion plea bargain, which again sounds like a lot of money until you juxtapose that against all the money they made doing this bad thing.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Stephen Brill about his investigative story about Johnson & Johnson and the antipsychotic drug Risperdal. His story is called America's Most Admired Lawbreaker. It's at the Huffington Post. And so did you get a chance to talk to Johnson & Johnson about this? They, by the way, did not comment when we asked them to comment on this for the show.
Oh, I spent hours talking to their lawyers and their public relations people. I wanted to interview the CEO of the company, Alex Gorsky, who was promoted to be CEO at the same time they were negotiating this $2.2 billion plea bargain. And before that, he was, guess what? He was the president of the unit that made Risperdal. And just before that, when all this activity was going on, he was the sales manager of that unit, who was responsible for all the promotional activities that we've just been talking about. Their view of the world is twofold. One is what they did was relatively narrow, and it's totally legal for a doctor to prescribe this drug. The drug, they say, is a very good drug, which in many, many contexts is absolutely true. But their second argument, and it's a developing argument that I think we're going to see develop a lot in the next year or two, is that there are First Amendment issues related to restricting a drug company from saying what it believes to be true about its drug.
But what does this mean in terms of the FDA and its mandate and whether or not that should be changed, whether they should have regulations governing the actual use of the drugs, not just the marketing of them?
Well, that is the real question, isn't it? The conservative argument is, well, if a doctor prescribes a drug off-label and it has a bad effect, then the doctor can be sued. But those same conservatives are the ones who are, always advocating to tear away the tort system so that doctors can't be sued like that. So, someone needs to be responsible. The 12-year-old boy who started taking Risperdal and got 46 double D breaths, you can't take the view that he and his mother and father, that it was buyer beware. The doctor was reading the label, and the label didn't say anything about don't give this drug to children because it might cause them to grow 46 double D breasts. So where should the responsibility lie? The FDA and the statutes say that the responsibility lies with the FDA to control what drug companies can say about drugs and how they can promote their drugs.
Well, and I also wonder about the punishment mechanism, because, as you say, $2.2 billion in fines sounds like a lot, but they were still able to make $4 to $8 billion in profits.
I mean, that's a whole set of other questions that I think, sort of in a serendipitous way, this whole story, which is why I got interested in it, this whole story illustrates. It's rare that the CEO of what is probably one of the most admired companies in the world, and in fact, by all surveys, the most admired healthcare company, it's rare that the CEO of that company, it turns out, was the sales manager responsible for exactly the sales and promotional activity that the government said was criminal. So, you know, you always hear the government argue, as they did with the banks and as they've argued in other cases lately, you know, with General Motors, we can't get enough evidence to hold an individual responsible. This guy, he's the guy on the ground who is responsible for this, and yet, as in every other case you can think of, it's the corporation that pleads guilty, it's the corporation that pays the fine. And that means if, just to take an example, if you have a 401k or if you have a pension plan, the pension plan probably owns Johnson & Johnson stock because it's a very good stock. So you paid that fine.
All right, you're halfway through the series, right?
Right.
So what's coming up?
We're getting to the point where the government starts to close in. They start taking discovery. Plaintiffs' lawyers start to close in. There are all kinds of, shall we say, scorched earth legal battles that Johnson & Johnson wages in its own defense. At the same time, this elaborate chess game starts with the government prosecutors, where they basically arrive at the bargain I've just described.
Stephen Brill, you can read and listen to his series, America's Most Admired Lawbreaker, at the Huffington Post. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up on the program, being a teenager can be hard.
On June 8th, it'll be the 10-year anniversary of my brother deciding to leave the world. My brother was 18 at the time. He was there one day and gone the next.
Suicide is the second leading cause of death for teens and young adults, but there are warnings on antidepressants that have dissuaded doctors from prescribing them. We talk about when and how these drugs should be prescribed after a news update with Eric Roy.
This podcast is produced by KCRW, a nonprofit public radio station based in Los Angeles. We rely on listeners like you. Support the podcasts you love by becoming a member. Go to kcrw.com/join.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. According to a new analysis, the popular antidepressant Paxil is not safe or effective for teenagers. The finding doesn't come from new research, but reworked data from an earlier study that came to exactly the opposite conclusion. Meanwhile, the argument continues over whether antidepressants can actually make kids more prone to suicide. But with suicide from depression the second leading cause of death of adolescents and young adults in the United States, the question becomes to prescribe or not to prescribe. Dr. Adam Kaplan is assistant professor of psychiatry and behavioral sciences at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks, Madeline. Glad to be here.
Well, nice to have you. And tell us about the original study. It was several years ago, I think 2001. What did it find, and what does this reworking indicate?
So the original study back in 2001 reported that Paxil was well-tolerated and effective very shortly after its publication, however. For example, as a result of the FDA evaluating the same study, looking at the actual data and saying it was a failed trial, it had come under a lot of criticism. And that criticism has continued to this day, largely because of what I think could be best characterized as the appearance of a cover-up. So this is published by the Journal of the American Academy of Child and Adolescent Psychiatry, and there have been calls ever since 2002 for the journal to retract this publication, and there has been, as of the latest, I believe this week, there was a report that went out from the Academy to its members saying, we are standing by this study, basically that there's no need to try to withdraw it. So it came under questions very early on.
A cover-up by whom?
What I said was it gives the appearance of a cover-up that the journal has not been willing to retract an article that clearly has been shown now independently by a number of groups to not actually show what it had set out to show. And the reason why I stress sort of the appearance of the cover-up as being the main issue is because Paxil really hasn't been used for a decade by child and adolescent psychiatrists because of the known concern about the potential increase in suicidality, which is also associated with the fact that it doesn't help. Paxil doesn't do better than a sugar pill at treating kids with depression.
Well, is this finding specific to Paxil, or should we extrapolate to all antidepressants in that category, other SSRIs?
Right. So that's a great question. And what I can tell you is that the best data that I know of that says that these antidepressants really save lives is that since the black box warning got instituted in 2004, there's been roughly, and the numbers differ a little bit depending on the study, but roughly a 30% decrease in the prescription of antidepressants as a whole to kids, and there has been a corresponding 30% increase in the suicide rate. So the main issue is that this is, and you put it really brilliantly, Madeline, the issue is that this is the second leading cause of death for adolescents and young adults of the age of 10 to 24. Major issue, sort of a silent epidemic, if you will, going on under our very noses, and because of the stigma associated with mental illness and the black box warning, people have stopped treating this lethal condition in kids. So to get back to your original...
And the black box warning, basically, it's on all antidepressants, or are these kinds of antidepressants, I should say, the SSRIs, saying that it can increase the risk of suicidal ideation.
Correct. And you're right. It's on all antidepressants now. So in order to be conservative, the FDA basically extended it not only from all antidepressants, but for all individuals up to the age of 24.
Okay.
But what is important to know, and we actually just published a study on this about a month ago, is that it's really during the first 2 weeks, but maybe 2 to 4 weeks of starting an SSRI, that the risk increases, not that kids will become suicidal, but if they're already suicidal, there's an increased risk when you first start these medicines for them to make kids more agitated and impulsive. But after that period, these treatments actually improve. Not all of them, but we do know, for instance, that Prozac and Lexapro are FDA approved to treat major depression in kids. And there's no reason not to treat it if you find it using those medicines for which there's clear evidence they're efficacious.
Now, you're talking about major depression, not just feeling blue or sad, normal teenage angst.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So no one is jonesing out on the street for Prozac. It has no street value. It doesn't lift your mood unless you already are clinically depressed. So it's a great point.
Okay. And so earlier you said there was a 30% drop in prescriptions of antidepressants since the black box warnings, and also a 30% increase in suicide. So are you linking the two?
Yeah, so actually, if you look at the data, it's pretty dramatic. If you look at the suicide rate among young males, between 1995 to 2004, the rates just were plummeting. They were going down dramatically because these antidepressants were felt to be much safer than the older antidepressants before the 90s. And so pediatricians who see most of these kids, because there's just a lot more pediatricians than there are child psychiatrists, were then saying, okay, I can handle this. I can treat these kids. So they were treating the depression not just with meds, but with talk therapy and the like, with the black box warning. Basically, it scared the bejesus out of the pediatricians about treating the depression, so they stopped doing it, is the most likely explanation for the data.
And then the 30% increase happened after that?
Exactly.
So are you worried then this news about Paxil will again further stigmatize the use of antidepressants?
Well, I think that, Madeline, exactly what you're doing now is the most important point, that there is an issue here. And I think the issue is about really that if you go back and look at the 2001 study, it was a study done by individuals who were paid literally hundreds of thousands of dollars by the same company that was having their drug tested, was, you know, paying out huge amounts of money to the authors and designers of this study. So we have now, you know, we do not now in academic circles, most academic circles, allowed pharmaceutical reps into Hopkins, for instance. We've tried to really separate the business of medicine and the art of medicine from the business of pharmaceutical companies. This was a misdirection in that particular area where there was just too close a coziness between the people who did that study and the implications for the millions of dollars for the drug company to gain if these people found positive results. But that's specific to Paxil. And again, I'm not going to, you know, go down the line about what will or wouldn't work, but I will say that Prozac and Lexapro both have FDA approval for young kids and adolescents to treat their major depression. So without question, I can adamantly say that this is a safe, these are safe medicines. In fact, what I would say is it's unsafe to not use these medicines in the face of a suicidal depression with severe depression in kids.
Right. I think, but people, though, are worried, parents are worried that there is this overprescribing of these medications for kids who may have behavioral or anxiety disorders and who are not clinically depressed.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because what's happening a lot and is kind of ironic that rather than say, okay, well, you know, parents don't want their kids prescribed anything, what's happening is that, unfortunately, kids are being prescribed much more Ritalin or antipsychotics because there's no black box warning for antipsychotics in the use of kids. Unfortunately, there's no good evidence to say that antipsychotics, atypical antipsychotics, actually help depression in kids. So what's happened is, you know, parents don't want to see their kids failing out of school. They don't want to see them, you know, going into a shell, missing their social developmental milestones, et cetera. So they are going and they're saying, please, can you help me with my child? And the pediatricians are prescribing medicines like Ritalin and antipsychotics rather than the medicines that really can help because of the stigma.
Dr. Adam Kaplan, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry and Behavioral Sciences at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Madeline. Thanks for bringing this stuff up.
And we want to hear from you. What's your experience with antidepressants? We'd like to hear from you if you took them as a child or if you're a parent with a child on an antidepressant. Let us know on Facebook at KCRW Press Play. And we're joined now by Warren Olney, who is here for a preview.
I am indeed, and we're looking forward to a very interesting conversation about the Pope visiting first, of course, in Cuba, mm-hmm. where he is today. We'll get some very interesting conversation with the Vatican reporter for who is following the Pope on what he said. A very interesting contrary view from one of the diplomats who's been with the Castro brothers the longest. He was part of the original revolution, and talk about his own Catholicism and what happened to it, with Raul Castro saying he might go back to the church again.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh,
and then we'll look forward to what's going to happen when the Pope gets here and what either political party, Democrat or Republican, is going to how they're going to deal with him.
Okay. Look forward to that very timely discussion at 1 o'clock on To the Point with Warren Olney. And coming up on this show, Steve Lopez, the LA Times columnist, is here to talk about what it was like to be an Uber driver. Yeah, he did it. Next on Press Play.
Listen to KCRW's 24-hour all-news channel. Stream BBC World Service, NPR, and KCRW programs. Continuous coverage and accessible via our smartphone app or online at kcrw.com.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Well, if you rode in an Uber last week, last Wednesday, to be exact, you might have found yourself being interviewed by your driver. That's because LA Times columnist Steve Lopez spent a day as an Uber driver, and he wrote about it in his latest piece out today. Hi, Steve.
Hey, how are you doing?
I'm great. Well, did you enjoy yourself?
I did. Do you need a ride anywhere?
I do, actually, after the show is over. Can you come pick me up?
I can, yes.
So you just wanted to see what it was like to be a driver?
Well, you know, if you're in the news biz, you got to have a plan B. You never know what's
going to
happen.
Yeah, right. That's
right?
True, especially now that your publisher is gone.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So I thought I would just check it out. I mean, no, it's I've been focusing on the economy in my column this year, and this is, as you know, a big part of the so-called sharing economy. Yeah. And, you know, there's some great things about the sharing economy and some not so great things. And I wanted to see specifically, what do the customers have to say, the passengers? Do they like it? And do any of them wonder about whether this is a good thing for the drivers?
Mm-hmm.
Because I don't know anybody who has had problems with Uber as a passenger. It seems to be universally loved, with maybe just a few exceptions. But there's a lot of grumbling among drivers and their Uber driver forums where, you know, they're complaining about this or complaining about that, and essentially saying that they don't make out very well when you add it all up and subtract their expenses. And I wanted to see how that played out.
Yeah, and so, well, first, before we get to that, did you like your customers?
You know what? It was fun. I mean, it's also a good way to go fishing for column material. I mean, there were three or four people I had who I thought could have been turned into to good columns. My very first passenger worked for the Chavez Foundation, and her parents were pickers up in the Santa Cruz, Watsonville area, and they've now returned to Mexico. So she you know, grows up in a labor family and ends up at Chavez, but she's taking Uber when taxi drivers are complaining, and there are protests around the world about what Uber means to steady, sometimes full-time jobs for cab riders. So, you know, I could have done a column just on her.
The irony's right there. Well, okay, now I want to get to how much money you made.
Yeah, well, okay, so I had done a few rides here and there just to make sure I understood how to use the app and all of that. And then I thought, okay, last week I'm going to drive all day. So I went out at 9 a.m. I drove until 5 p.m. And since so much of the Uber action and the surge pricing, where the demand is so great that the passenger has to pay more, happens in the evening, I went back out for, I don't know, another hour or 90 minutes on Wednesday night. So I did a total of 9 hours. The fares range from short $4 type fares to a long one. I had $44. So 9 hours, $153.30. But Uber takes $30.66 of that. So that leaves me $122, and I had to use 3 or 4 gallons of gas. So you subtract that, and I'm down to $110 net, $12.22 an hour. So I think I'm going to not give away my typewriter.
$12.22 an hour. Well, so then most Uber drivers probably have another job. They do this on the side.
That's one thing about it. And when I spoke to Uber about this, it's not a full-time job for most people. And most drivers, apparently, you know, I'm talking about the grumbling drivers, but a lot of drivers like it. And as Uber said, look, they hear stories about somebody, you know, the refrigerator breaks and you don't have money in your budget to replace it. Well, you go out and you drive long as it takes to get yourself a new Frigidaire or to pay for a family vacation. And that's how a lot of Uber drivers seem to be operating. And if that's what you're doing, I mean, I guess that's okay. But if you want to make a full-time living at this, it means lots and lots of hours. And then you've got to figure in not just the cost of gas, but the wear and tear on your car. And then there are insurance issues as well that come into play. And so it gets a little more complicated if you think this is a career.
Right. Well, tell me about, do you have any interface with the company itself? Did you have any interactions with managers or?
Well, I signed up not telling anybody who I was, and I just went and had my car inspected. And by the way, they rejected me at first. I'm driving a Toyota Prius, and I thought it was in fine condition. And I go for the inspection. They say, we can't pass you. The rear windshield wiper is a little bit frayed, and you're going to have to replace it before we can approve you. I was surprised by that because the taxi people were saying, you know, they're pretty loose on the requirements. So they did require me to do that, and they did a background check that, you know, it was about a week, 10 days, maybe 2 weeks before I heard back from them. But I didn't tell them who I was. I did tell every passenger.
So how did they do the correct background check?
Oh, no, you have to give them your information, but okay. I didn't say, and by the way, my real job is to write columns, and I'm writing about this. But, you know, I did tell all of my passengers look, this is not my first job, my real job, and I'm doing some research. Are you willing to talk to me about Uber? And every single one of them wanted to talk, and it was universal raves about Uber. And by the way, you know, Uber drivers get rated from 0 stars to five. I'm proud to say that I am a 5-star Uber driver.
Oh, wow. Well, maybe you should have second thoughts about making this occur. I think you should look into this. You're obviously very good at it. But do you, this is one thing I wanted to know, an inside piece of knowledge. Do you actually rate the passengers?
Oh, yes, you do. You do. When the ride, I don't know if you have to, but when the ride is over, I get a little pop-up that says rate the last passenger, and you rate them, and then you're able to move on to the next trip.
What do you rate them on?
Were they courteous? Were they nice to me? Did they leave a mess in the car? I think I would rate them pretty low. Were they drunk and vomiting? Would be a pretty low rating generally.
That is 0 star right there.
Yeah, but I had 4- and 5-star passengers. I had a couple who didn't even talk to me. They were on the phone or something and acted like I wasn't there. But hey, that's part of the deal.
Did you give them a 5-star?
I did not give everybody a 5-star. No.
All right. Steve Lopez, columnist for the Los Angeles Times. That's his day job anyway. Thanks, Steve.
Hey, thank you.
Well, if you were trying to Uber around downtown last night, you might have hit an award show traffic jam. Only in L.A. The Emmys were last night, and host Andy Samberg opened the show with a bit of existential TV angst.
Did you guys see Game of Thrones?
Oh, when he died.
Yes.
My goodness.
I haven't seen it yet.
Oh, how about Orange is the New Black?
Oh, wow.
I'm addicted.
Love it.
That incredible. I've been meaning to. I'm going to catch up.
Have you been watching Mad Men, though?
Oh, girl. Beautiful. So great.
It's on my DVR. I'm going to see it.
You've seen Empire, right?
Not yet.
Transparent?
No.
Ray Donovan.
Downton Abbey?
Girls?
The Americans.
Bloodline?
How sensitive.
So you think you can
Big
dance?
Big Bang Theory?
Kimmy Schmidt?
The Leftovers?
Stop!
So many shows. And so little time.
So much TV, so little time. That's why we talk TV every Monday. And here with your guide for what to watch is Michael Schneider, Chief Content Officer for TV Guide Magazine and host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Hi there.
Hi, Madeline.
And Alan Sepinwall, TV critic for the entertainment news website HitFix. Hi, Alan.
Hey, Madeline.
Let's start with the Emmys and last night's big winner.
And the Emmy goes to John Hamm, not him.
Okay, so finally.
A lot of great first-time winners this year. So John Hamm finally getting that Emmy that we've been expecting for years for his portrayal of Don Draper, but Viola Davis from How to Get Away with Murder, Jeffrey Tambor from Transparent. It was a good night for first-timers.
Yeah, what'd you think, Ellen?
I was pleased. I mean, I went into it basically saying as long as John Hamm won, anything else would be gravy, but there was a lot of good stuff beyond that. Tambor is 70 years old and somehow never won an Emmy for Arrested Development or The Larry Sanders Show. I thought that was great. Viola Davis's speech was just pure fire. That was fantastic. And, you know, this was not my favorite season of Game of Thrones, but it probably should have won an Emmy at some point, so why not?
Yeah, and Veep had a great season, and for it to win the Best Comedy Emmy and also finally put a stop to Modern Family's steamrolling over the competition was fresh as well. So overall, it feels like they pretty much got it right.
And Olive Kittredge. I mean, that won a bunch of Emmys. I was
TV
surprised.
Academy members loved Olive Kittredge, apparently.
I mean, if you look at it, HBO, they had the best comedy, the best drama, the best miniseries, and the best movie. And the only reason I think that they didn't have the best variety talk show was because people wanted to give The Daily Show one more award out the door. I could see them, like, sweeping all of it next year.
Yeah, altogether, HBO won 14 awards Sunday night, which was more than everyone else combined. There's only 26 categories on Sunday night, so everyone else cobbled together 12. So it was an insane night for HBO. Also the first time that any network has won both Outstanding Drama and Comedy at the Emmys since 2002 when NBC did it.
Oh, my gosh. So who got robbed? who walked away not
Amy smiling. Poehler has never won an Emmy for playing Leslie Knope and now never will. That just seems wrong to me.
I was about to say Amy Poehler as well. That's probably the big one that we were hoping for. And, you know, it might have been nice to see David Letterman go out with one final win. But, of course, you know, Daily Show was also going out. So you stack up, you know, in its tenure, Daily Show won 10 in a row. So clearly Academy voters loved The Daily Show and wanted to say farewell to Jon Stewart with one last Emmy.
Okay, let us move on to a big series premiere this week. It's Minority Report. It premieres tonight on Fox. Here's a clip.
When we were 9, they started testing us.
They called it the pre-crime program. The three of us were seeing visions of every murder within 100 miles. And then it ended. Pre-crime was abolished.
This is, of course, based on the Tom Cruise, Steven Spielberg movie that came out in 2002. And when that came out, it was after 9/11, and people saw it as really an astute commentary on the police state and freedom of expression and freedom of will. And how does the TV show stack up, Alan?
It's not very good. And first of all, it's just a complete, almost perversion of the idea of the movie, which is Tom Cruise goes through the movie and figures out, hey, pre-crime is bad. It's not fair to lock up people for things they haven't done yet or might never do. And now here they're deciding, oh, wait, we need pre-crime back. And it's just kind of a mediocre. They've taken this idea and turned it into a mediocre sci-fi police procedural.
I think the best part is probably Megan Good, who stars in the show and who's a real talent. And hopefully we'll eventually find maybe the proper vehicle. But I'm kind of with Alan. You know, it's one of those things where I love the movie, but there isn't still enough of a reason to turn it into an ongoing TV series, in my opinion.
Well, lots of movies have been turned into TV shows. MASH, for example.
MASH is obviously one of the biggest shows of all time, one of the biggest television shows of all time. But it's almost the exception to the rule. Movies that are turned into TV shows have about the same success rate as any TV show, which means most fail.
Oh, okay. What about Fargo, though? Would that be an exception?
That'd be another.
Fargo's incredible. It has no business being as good as it is. I mean, you're trying to do a Coen Brothers adaptation. That should be folly. And it was amazing in the first season. I've seen the first two episodes of the new season. I love it.
Yeah, it is fantastic. Another good example of taking something but then reinterpreting it for television, and the folks behind that did a fantastic job.
Okay, The Muppets premieres tomorrow on ABC, and Alan, you have seen the show. What is your opinion?
I am very disappointed in The Muppets. Bill Prady, the co-creator of The Big Bang Theory, his career started off working for the Jim Henson Company, so I thought he, of all people, doing a Muppet show would sort of understand what makes them tick. And he's come up with this conceit. It's not just a mockumentary, but it's his theory is that these are finally the quote-unquote real versions of Kermit and Miss Piggy and Fozzie and everyone else. And everything we've seen previously are characters they were playing. And the real versions of them are really abrasive and cynical and sour in a way that the Muppets just shouldn't be.
Yeah, we don't need that in our Muppets. We have that everywhere else. We want our Muppets to be pure.
Yeah, I'm holding out hope. I'm going to remain optimistic. I didn't hate it as much as a lot of critics have, just because it's still fun to see all of them on television. And we'll see. I'm going to give it a little more.
What's happening between Miss Piggy and Kermit?
It's not good. They've broken up. And what happens is the one thing that made Miss Piggy a little bit softer and more tolerable in every other incarnation was she loved Kermit. So this was one good thing you could say about this pig who was otherwise a complete diva and treated everyone else awfully. Now she's even treating Kermit badly.
Yeah, it's a Sonny and Cher relationship. But the later day Sonny and Cher, after they broke up, but they were still paired together because they were in a business relationship. And that's the case here.
That's sad.
Those two maybe will make it work. They'll work it out. Who knows?
If they can't make it work, come on. What hope do we have?
Exactly.
The rest of us. Alan Sepinwall, TV critic for HitFix, an entertainment news site, and Michael Schneider, chief content officer for TV Guide magazine and host of KCRW's The Spinoff. Thanks, both of you.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
Julie Myers is here now with the listener feedback. Hello.
Hello and happy Monday.
Are the listeners in high dudgeon?
They are, about everything. We have so much to choose from today. I love it. It's the happiest of all Mondays. So we talked about Steve Lopez, his second career as an Uber driver. And we actually had a few tweets of people talking about the rating system and how arbitrary the whole thing is. Apparently, you have to keep a 4.7 out of 5 in your rating or you're fired as an Uber driver.
Really?
But there are people who are just going to be like, 3 every time they get out of the car, 3 stars. What does it all actually mean? There's no rubric to judge by. And so Nicholas Slayton is calling for a system of yes or no. Did you like your driver? Did you not like your driver? That's a much more fair way of doing things, apparently. I didn't know that, although I live in fear of being rated
explode.
Yeah, I had no idea. So, and sometimes I've misrated and I felt really bad.
Like,
about
oops,
it.
Whatever. Yeah, fired. Okay, so elsewhere in the car world, the VW owners are furious. Furious. Ian, who owns an Audi A3 diesel, VW makes those. He bought it in 2010. He just paid it off and he is sick that he's been polluting much more than he thought. He feels burned and ripped off and lied to, and he will never, ever buy anything from VW ever again. Jeff has a Golf diesel, and he says that he feels like an accomplice to VW's pollution now. He's sick at the idea that every time he took his kid to school or drove to work, that he was polluting up to 40 times more than he thought he was. Again, VW has lost a customer.
That is going to be a huge, huge problem for VW.
That's right.
Years ahead. I mean, jeez.
I don't even own one, and I'm like,
I know. All right. Well, Julie Myers, thank you for that. And listeners, you want to weigh in on anything, our Twitter is at KCRW Press Play. Warren Olney is up next at 1 o'clock with To The Point, so keep it right here on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Have a great afternoon. I'll see you tomorrow.